In the quiet neighborhood of Hyde Park in Kansas City, Missouri, sat a house that no one would have suspected to harbor unimaginable horrors. But within its walls, the eccentric flea market vendor Robert Berdella transformed into something far darker. Neighbors knew him as a quirky collector and local crime prevention advocate, but inside his unassuming home, Berdella conducted heinous experiments in pain and control that defied comprehension. When Christopher Bryson leapt from a second-story window, wearing nothing but a dog collar, the facade shattered, and the world glimpsed the monster lurking beneath the surface. In this episode, we'll take you inside the House of Horrors, exploring the methods, motives, and madness of Robert Berdella's gruesome crimes. Building on the foundation of episode one, where we trace Berdella's evolution from a troubled youth to an emerging predator, we now step into the heart of his darkest deeds. We'll examine how his carefully curated public persona shielded his true identity, the calculated ways he lured and tormented his victims, and the chilling evidence uncovered by law enforcement. We'll also delve into the systemic gaps that allowed him to remain undetected for years and discuss the profound impact of his crimes on the victims' families, the Kansas City community, and criminal justice. This is Scarlet Tavern. All right, part two.
Back at it.
This one is a definitely view. Listener discretion advised.
Ben didn't say it. I expected him to say it.
What?
I said part two.
I don't get it.
Every time last season, part two, Electric Boogaloo.
I did that like twice.
You did it every time. Do you want to go back and listen?
I don't remember that.
Every time he would say it.
You want me to do it?
No.
No.
It's ruined now. You ruined it.
Wow, okay.
You can never say it again.
You know what? I defy you. Electric Boogaloo.
Will you just shut the up?
You said it wrong.
Love you, though.
That would have been more like in there if you didn't stutter through it.
I know.
All right, so we're back with episode two of the new season. Just a reminder that we are not just a true crime podcast. We do have a D&D podcast, Dungeons and Magi, that is also on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, anywhere you get your podcasts. We are in a great campaign now, a post-apocalyptic campaign with hints of magic and technology, Magitech. And we have some amazing one-shots coming out from some sponsors. If anybody has listened to the podcast Old Gods of Appalachia, we are going to be doing the TTRPG based off of their podcast.
I cannot wait for that.
I'm not in that one.
We're doing Delta Green, which is another amazing one. We're doing City of Mist. So we've got a ton of stuff going on over there, as well as our holiday one shots that we do. We also sell dice, so we have our dice company. You can go to dammedialloc.com and find all of that stuff there. We may design some Scarlet Tavern dice or dice based off of some of the topics for Scarlet Tavern.
I'm still waiting for the fuck you, fuck me, yeet, no yeet.
I'm not sure how well a Robert Berdella dice set would sell.
Yeah, probably not. But a Ted Bundy set would sell.
I mean, on the face of the 20, you could do a knife.
Mm.
Or is like,
well, not for him.
Or like, I like to call it a people opener.
Not for him. I wouldn't do that. But because his big thing was bleach and...
Yeah.
So a bleach bottle.
No, I would do a needle.
Yeah.
Because that's what he used. He injected them. Or just put meth on it, on the D20. but yeah, so check all that at dammedialloc.com. Again, we also have a Facebook page for this as well. And we have social medias for all of our other stuff. If TikTok truly does go bye-bye, everything can be found on those socials. So again, we want to thank you for listening in, and let's jump in. So, the true horror of Robert Berdella's crimes lies in the detail of his sadistic methods. As his confidence grew with each victim, so did his appetite for inflicting prolonged suffering. What follows is an expanded account of the depths of Berdella's depravity. Each crime marked by systematic torture, calculated experimentation, and meticulous documentation. Viewer discretion is advised.
Wouldn't that be listener discretion? Because nobody...
If they watch us on YouTube.
Yeah, but there's no...
But they're still watching on YouTube. Still counts as a watch.
Just everybody be prepared. Some fucked up shit's about to be said.
Yeah.
July 5th through the 6th, 1984. Jerry Howell, a 19-year-old acquaintance and son of a fellow flea market vendor, approached Berdella for a ride to a dance contest. Yes, you heard that right. Berdella, harboring long-held fantasies of control over Howell, seized the opportunity. Offering a ride, he instead took Howell to his home under false pretenses, initiating a sinister plan. Berdella spiked Howell's drink with sedatives, rendering him semi-conscious. Once Howell could no longer resist, Berdella bound him to his bed with ropes. Not to his bed, by the way. It's actually the spare bed. Over the course of 28 hours, Berdella raped Howell multiple times, combining physical domination with degrading verbal abuse. He taunted Howell, mocking his inability to fight back and reinforcing his sense of helplessness. Berdella alternated between moments of calm and intense abuse, creating a psychological roller coaster designed to break Howell's spirits. Howell eventually vomited due to the effects of the sedatives while gagged, causing asphyxiation. Berdella later claimed to have attempted CPR, but his lack of effort underscored his indifference to Howell's life. Berdella meticulously dismembered Howell's body, draining the blood and sectioning the remains using a chainsaw and boning knives. Each body part was carefully wrapped in plastic trash bags and left for curbside garbage collection.
And we'll be going more in depth further down of each crime, each death.
Yeah. Do you have in there what he writes in his notebooks?
Think I do,
because he makes notes for everything. He literally documents everything he does. That's how we know all of this is true. Because
I think his notebooks do come.
Because there is a specific thing that he writes about this.
Yeah, handwriting.
Okay. Because there's a specific thing he says about Jerry Howell in his notes. So we'll get to that later.
Yeah, there is.
Okay.
This is definitely the riskiest of all. Of all his victims, this was probably the riskiest
one. Yes, it was the only one that did not have, or that had a connection to somebody. And I think it was just his urges. They got to him. He found the opportunity, and he took it.
He's very much, like, an opportunist. Like,
oh, yeah.
A lot of these were just, hey, yeah, sure, whatever. And then...
Well, aside from Howell, he could relate to everybody else because they were druggies. The male prostitutes, they're gay.
Howell actually came out as...
He did, yes. But he did not know that at first.
No. At first, he was pissed off at Howell because he was picking on like gay people and bullying them and everything. But then it came out that he was also gay.
April 1985. Robert Shelvin, a 20-year-old drifter, had stayed with Berdella intermittently. While initially attending to offer shelter, Berdella became annoyed with Shelvin's presence and decided to make him a victim. His frustration marked a shift from premeditated murder to impulsive violence. Sheldon was drugged over several days, reducing his ability to resist. Once incapacitated, Burdella bound him and began his experiments. Drain cleaner was swabbed into one of Sheldon's eyes, causing irreversible damage and excruciating pain. Piano wire was wrapped tightly around his wrist, cutting off circulation and causing nerve damage. Caulking material was poured into his ears to deafen him, isolating him further. Sheldon was repeatedly raped, his struggles met with taunts from Burdella, who treated him as an object rather than a person. When a workman was scheduled to visit Burdella's home, he decided to kill Sheldon to avoid discovery. Using a plastic bag and a ligature, Burdella suffocated him, displaying cold, calculated detachment. Sheldon's body was dismembered using the same method as Howell's. His skull was later found in Burdella's closet, a grotesque trophy of the crime. Not just that. He was having fellatio with the head, from what we can tell.
Jesus.
Yeah. June 1985. Mark Wallace, a 20-year-old drifter, sought shelter from a storm in Burdella's tool shed. Burdella saw an opportunity and invited Wallace inside, where he quickly incapacitated him with a heavy dose of tranquilizers. Burdella connected an electrical transformer to Wallace's nipples and genitals, delivering repeated shocks. He meticulously recorded Wallace's physical reactions, treating the ordeal as a sadistic experiment. Burdella inserted needles into Wallace's back muscles, a technique designed to inflict maximum pain and terror. Wallace, unable to escape or resist, endured taunts and manipulative behavior that reinforced his hopelessness. Wallace died after approximately 24 hours of torture, succumbing to the combined effect of drugs, respiratory distress, and trauma. Burdella followed his established routine of dismembering the body and disposing of the remains in trash bags, treating the process with clinical detachment. September 26, 1985. James Ferris, a 25-year-old acquaintance, reached out to Burdella for shelter. Burdella, intending to make Ferris his next victim, drugged him soon after arrival and restrained him. Ferris endured hours of electrical shocks, timed in intervals to maximize pain and prolong suffering. Burdella meticulously recorded the duration and intensity of each session. Ferris's neck and shoulders became the focus of Burdella's sadistic experiments, with hypodermic needles penetrating sensitive areas. Ferris was repeatedly raped and subjected to escalating physical violations designed to break his body and spirit. Ferris's body succumbed after 27 hours of relentless abuse. Burdella noted in his logs the precise moment Ferris's breathing slowed and stopped, marking his death as a calculated endpoint to his suffering. June 17th to July 1st, 1986. Todd Stoops, a 23-year-old male prostitute and acquaintance, was lured to Burdella's home under the pretense of a meal. Burdella, who found Stoops physically attractive, drugged and restrained him. Ammonia was swabbed into Stoops' eyes, temporarily blinding him. Drain cleaner was injected into his larynx to silence him, causing severe internal damage. Stoops endured repeated rapes, including injuries so severe that they led to sepsis. Burdella took pleasure in his victim's suffering, using it as a source of sexual gratification. Burdella alternated between moments of violence and small rewards, such as offering Stoops ice cream, deepening his despair. Stoops died after nearly 2 weeks of physical and emotional torture, succumbing to septic shock caused by his injuries. Burdella noted his decline in detached clinical detail. Larry Wayne Pearson, June to August 1987. Larry Wayne Pearson, a 20-year-old acquaintance, was held captive for 6 weeks. Burdella used this extended period to refine his methods of control. Burdella shattered Pearson's hand bones with an iron rod, rendering him defenseless. High-voltage shocks were administered repeatedly, focusing on sensitive areas like the genitals. Pearson's vocal cords were damaged with drain cleaner to ensure silence. Burdella rewarded compliance with small privileges, reinforcing its dominance and prolonging Pearson's suffering. After weeks of abuse, Pearson bit Burdella's penis during an assault, an act that enraged Burdella. Burdella bludgeoned Pearson unconscious with a tree limb before suffocating him with a plastic bag.
Jesus.
Robert Berdella's descent into violence was not a series of impulsive acts, but a meticulously planned campaign of domination, torture, and murder. Each victim's death was a calculated event, meticulously documented in logs and photographs. The details of his crimes reflect a chilling blend of sadistic pleasure, scientific detachment, and a growing confidence that he could act without consequence. His ability to manipulate, dehumanize, and destroy his victims marked him as one of history's most depraved serial killers.
One sick puppy. This is what happens when people have too much time on their fucking hands.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So, by the time Robert Berdella claimed his second and third victims, his sadistic tendencies had transformed from brutal experimentation into a calculated, systematic process of torture and control. This period of Berdella's reign of terror saw him refining his methods, developing his ability to psychologically manipulate his victims, and explore new, even more grotesque forms of violence. Each subsequent crime revealed a man who was not only unrepentant, but actively honing his ability to maximize suffering and assert total dominance over his victims. And I will say, Robert Berdella is bad. Yeah. Almost as bad as the Toy Box Killer. That's one of the ones that's even worse.
Oh.
The Toy Box Killer is bad. And it all happens in a fucking truck.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah,
I haven't gotten to that one yet.
In a moving truck. He's a piece of shit. His girlfriend was in on it.
I haven't gotten to that one yet.
Yeah. It's nuts.
Is it Nightmare?
He did some fucked up shit and recorded everything. Like, video recorded everything.
Got it. So, nightmare-inducing shit.
Berdella's first murder, Jerry Howell, was a significant psychological turning point. What initially began as an act of opportunity turned into the foundation for a system of capture, torture, and murder. From his second victim onward, Berdella began incorporating a detailed methodology. Berdella specifically targeted young, transient men, those living on the margins of society, often involved in prostitution or struggling with addiction. Their lack of social connections made them ideal prey. Berdella lured his victims to his home under the guise of offering food, shelter, or money. His outwardly eccentric yet harmless persona allowed him to mask his true intentions effectively. Berdella relied on a combination of alcohol, sedatives, and physical violence to render his victims defenseless. Drugs such as Valium and chlorpromazine played a pivotal role in his ability to restrain victims without immediate resistance. Hey, we're back to drugs I can pronounce and you can't.
Valium and chlorazepam?
Chlorpromazine.
Oh, yeah. Chlorpromazine.
Yeah. Once incapacitated, Berdella subjected his victims to carefully planned acts of torture. These were not random. They were methodical, deliberate, and designed to inflict maximum pain when ensuring prolonged survival. Each session of torture was meticulously documented in handwritten logs and Polaroid photographs. These served as both trophies and a record of his experiments, reflecting his belief that he was conducting something akin to research. After his victims succumbed to the physical toll of his abuse, Berdella dismembered their bodies with the precision of a butcher, ensuring no trace of evidence could tie him to the crimes. So, this is when we go into a little more detail and the evolution of his practices. In April 1985, Robert Sheldon was not pre-selected as a victim. However, Berdella's frustration with Sheldon's presence in his home led to an impulsive decision to turn him into a captive. This marked Berdella's transition from premeditated targeting to opportunistic violence. Sheldon was subjected to experimental methods that became hallmarks of Berdella's crimes. Berdella swabbed drain cleaner into Sheldon's eyes, causing excruciating burns and likely permanent blindness. Caulking material was forced into Sheldon's ears, rendering him deaf and further isolating him from his surroundings. Piano wire was wrapped tightly around Sheldon's wrist, cutting off circulation inflicting nerve damage. Bradella later admitted to deriving satisfaction from watching Sheldon writhe in pain as the wire dug into his flesh. When a workman scheduled to visit Bradella's home risked exposing the crime, Bradella decided Sheldon had to die. His method, suffocation from using a plastic bag, was chillingly pragmatic, signaling Bradella's growing detachment from the act of killing itself. So this is where we start to see everything that he's going to do to his next victims.
It slowly builds.
Yeah.
In 1985, in June, Mark Wallace sought shelter in Bradella's tool shed during the storm. Bradella's willingness to victimize someone he did not know reflected his growing sense of invincibility. Bradella's experiments with electrical shocks reached new levels with Wallace. Using the electrical transformer connected to alligator clips, Bradella delivered jolts to Wallace's genitals and nipples, observing and recording his reactions. These shocks were applied intermittently to prolong Wallace's suffering without immediately killing him. So, just so you know, and we did this before.
Do you know what alligator clips look like?
No. Oh. That's... It is... So, we talked about this when we did this the first time. So, most of us in law enforcement, you've been hit with a taser.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it hurts like a bitch.
You have to be tased to carry one. So, 50,000 to 100,000 volts, usually, is what a taser is. It's less than 2 milliamps, or it is 2 milliamps. It's extremely low, and it's for a few seconds.
5 seconds.
Electrical transformer. 400,000 volts.
Yeah.
And he was doing it intermittently.
Fuck that.
It's like hooking him up to a car battery.
Yeah.
It's not fun. This literally says, a taser is designed to be relatively safe for incapacitating humans. Electrical transformer poses a significant risk of serious injury or death due to its ability to deliver high current.
You don't say.
Hypodermic needles as tools of pain. Bradella used needles to penetrate Wallace's muscles, inflicting deep, localized pain while documenting his victim's cries and physical responses. Bradella's logs noted Wallace's increasing exhaustion, a detail he seemed to relish. Despite Bradella's intention to prolong Wallace's ordeal, the combination of trauma, drug effects, and shock led to Wallace's death after 24 hours. Bradella coldly recorded Wallace's final breaths before proceeding with dismemberment, saying this is a mistake. He didn't give him the right meds to keep him alive.
Well, he doesn't know any better. He just, all his only interaction with drugs is the kind that he probably used himself.
Like, I know what meds to give somebody to keep them alive through torture. I'm not going to say it because people should know that.
Mm-hmm. Make sure to check his stuff every now and again. Make sure that he's not preparing something.
You do remember I went through this training.
Yeah, I know. Just making sure we're not going to have a repeat.
I mean, I could put you through the training.
Yeah, I don't want to do that.
Babe.
What?
Us combined. You should be very afraid.
Yeah, I'll just run away.
So September 1985, unlike Wallace, James Ferris was an acquaintance of Bradella's. The premeditated nature of his capture marked a return to deliberate targeting. Ferris was subjected to the most prolonged and intense sessions of torture up to that point. Bradella delivered shocks for up to 5 minutes at a time, timing them meticulously to push Ferris to the brink of unconsciousness. He recorded the victim's screams, convulsions, and pleas in his log, noting his own observations with clinical detachment. So, that, he's lucky he didn't have a heart attack in the first 5 minutes, because that's a long time. Tasers, again, lower voltage, 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Anything higher than that, you risk
irregular heartbeats, heart stopping. That's why it's very rarely, I want to say this, it's very rarely some cop will hit somebody with a taser who has a heart condition and it'll kill them. because it's very rare. It is. Almost
it happens, but at that point, play stupid games, you win stupid prizes.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. It's almost to the point, the amount of times it's happened, it's to the point, it's not even really a statistic. It's almost anecdotal.
Yeah. Over 20, Ferris's neck and shoulders became focal points for Bredella's needle experiments. Bredella's logs detail the depths and angles of insertion, reflecting his fascination with inflicting precise targeted pain. Over 27 hours, Ferris's condition deteriorated as his body succumbed to the cumulative effects of trauma, starvation, and sedation. Della later remarked that he viewed Ferris's death as a natural conclusion to his suffering. Now, Bredella's sadism extended beyond physical torture. He developed psychological manipulation techniques to break his victim's will and reinforce his dominance. Bredella would offer small comforts, such as allowing a victim to drink water or rest briefly, only to resume torture with greater intensity. This created a cycle of hope and despair, deepening his victim's psychological trauma. On top of this, he would offer ice cream. He would offer cigarettes. He asked if one of his victims, I believe it was Mark Wallace, if I remember right. He asked him what kind of cigarettes he smokes. And if he was good and didn't scream, he would give him cigarettes that he could smoke. Hundreds of photographs captured his victims in various stages of captivity, torture, and death. These images were carefully stored, providing Bredella with a visual archive of his crimes. Items belonging to his victims, including driver's licenses and personal effects, were retained as mementos. These objects served as reminders of the dominance long after the victim's death.
This is where he fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
By this point in his killing spree, Bredella's motivation had evolved from opportunistic violence to a calculated pursuit of control and sadistic pleasure. He no longer sought mere physical dominance. He craved the complete submission of his victims, both body and mind. His ability to refine his techniques through trial, documentation, and repetition made him an even more dangerous predator. As Bredella perfected his methods, his belief in his own invincibility grew. His careful planning, meticulous cleanup, and targeting of vulnerable individuals ensured that no one would suspect the horrors unfolding behind the walls of 4315 Charlotte Street. The stage was set for even greater atrocities. Bredella's confidence in sadism continued to escalate. By the mid-1980s, Robert Bredella had reached the zenith of his horrifying career of violence. No longer experimenting with methods or cautiously refining his practices, Bredella now operated with an unfettered confidence in his ability to torture, murder, and evade detection. This period, marked by his prolonged captivity of victims, the escalation of his sadistic practices, and the systemic dehumanization of those he preyed upon, underscored his transformation into a fully realized monster, devoid of empathy or restraint. All right. Are you ready for this? This is...
I know this one. I don't like this one.
This is the dark stuff. This here, folks, is listener discretion. This is where we are going in detail of everything that happened. I don't even have to read this. I could tell you what happened off the top of my head. I've read this so much. So some of it may sound repetitive, but we are going into more detail. Todd Stoops, a 23-year-old male prostitute, endured one of the most prolonged and sadistic periods of captivity under Bredella's control. This case is often cited as the height of Bredella's depravity, revealing the extent of his willingness to prolong suffering and his calculated cruelty. Stoops had previously stayed at Bredella's home with his wife on two occasions in 1984. Bredella harbored a sexual attraction to Stoops and fantasized about having complete control over him. By 1986, Stoops was estranged from his wife and living in dire conditions. Bredella encountered him in Liberty Memorial Park and offered him a meal and $13 for sexual favors. Stoops, desperate for money to buy drugs, agreed and accompanied Bredella to his home. cheap. She's a cheap whore.
Yeah, well, that desperate for drugs. Yeah.
$13 ain't getting you much.
Even back then.
Once in Berdella's clutches, Stoops was rendered powerless through drugs and restraints. Over the course of 2 weeks, Berdella's treatment of Stoops surpassed the horrors inflicted on his previous victims. Electrical shocks. Berdella used a 7,700-volt transformer to deliver high-voltage shocks to Stoops' genitals and other sensitive areas. These shocks were calculated to inflict excruciating pain while avoiding immediate death. I know from some accounts, he hooked them to his balls. He hooked them to the gooch, which, and his nipples. Yeah. Berdella ruptured Stoops' anal wall by using his fist, causing severe internal injuries that led to a massive infection. This act was intended to destroy Stoops' physical autonomy and further break his will. Berdella injected caustic substances directly into Stoops' vocal cords, leaving him unable to scream or plead for mercy. That's why I said a needle for his D20. Berdella alternated between acts of cruelty and moments of feigned kindness. For instance, he allowed Stoops minimal food and water and later offered him ice cream and soup, which Stoops was too weak to consume. These gestures served to deepen Stoops' despair and underscore his complete dependency on Berdella.
If I remember it from Marisha Cricket, the acts of the kindness that he did, it was after he started getting sick.
Yes, because he knew that he wasn't going to be able to eat anything. So it was psychological torture. He would also eat food in front of them when they got to the point that they couldn't eat. Keep in mind, if this guy even tried to eat something, it would be, so think about the last time you had a sore throat. Okay. Amplify that by 100. This guy just had bleach injected into his throat.
No.
By a needle from the outside.
Yeah, it's bad.
It's like, you know the rhino spray that goes in the bed liners of trucks?
Yeah.
That like really rough stuff? Imagine that sprayed in your throat. That's what his throat would have felt like. Yeah. It would have been, if we could have seen the inside of his throat, I would have loved to have actually looked at that, because it would have been swollen. It more likely would have been pussy, and like it would have been bad. Over the 2 weeks, Stoops was provided with little to no nourishment. This deliberate starvation further weakened him, ensuring he was physically incapable of resistance. Stoops' condition rapidly deteriorated due to sepsis caused by his ruptured anal wall, compounded by dehydration and malnutrition. Berdella's logs chillingly described his victim's inability to sit upright and a slow descent into unconsciousness. On July 1st, 1986, Stoops succumbed to his injuries. Berdella, showing no remorse, coldly recorded his death in his log and began the methodical process of dismembering and disposing of the body. Larry Wayne Pearson's six-week ordeal is the most prolonged of Berdella's crimes, demonstrating his complete mastery over his methods and his descent into a warped sense of justification for his actions. Pearson first met Berdella through his flea market booth, Bob's Bizarre Bazaar, in the wrong order, and the two formed a casual friendship. In June 1987, Pearson needed help after being arrested, and Berdella bailed him out, ostensibly out of kindness. While staying at Berdella's home to repay his debt, Pearson joked about robbing gay men. This remark enraged Berdella, who saw it as an affront to his sexuality. Fueled by anger and his desire for control, Berdella decided to make Pearson his next victim.
And this is where I really think he was like, he controlled himself to a degree.
Yeah.
Because nobody else survived more than 2 weeks. Nope. That's why I think he made this as long and painful as possible, because he joked about the robbing
gay people.
Gay men.
Pearson's captivity is notable for Berdella's psychological and physical dominance, as well as his escalating sadistic tendencies. Berdella deliberately broke the bones in Pearson's hands using an iron rod, rendering him physically helpless. The act was designed to ensure Pearson's complete submission. As with other victims, Berdella subjected Pearson to electrical shocks and injected drain cleaner into his vocal cords. Berdella attempted to create a system of rewards and punishments, moving Pearson to a less restrictive room as a reward for obedience. Pearson learned to sleep without moving, fearing that any slight disturbance would provoke further violence. And with that sleep without moving, that's a big notation because Robert Berdella slept in the bed right next to him. With all his victims. He would sleep in the bed right next to him while they were tied up and tortured. Berdella repeatedly rapes Pearson, treating him as an object for his own gratification. The logs detail these assaults with cold detachment, reflecting Berdella's complete dehumanization of his victim. So what he would do is he would sleep next to them. He would wake up and feel like raping them, so he would do it. And then he would go back to sleep while they're sitting there whining and crying. Despite weeks of compliance, Pearson ultimately resisted, biting Berdella's penis during an assault and screaming that he could no longer endure the abuse. This act of defiance enraged Berdella, who responded with fatal violence. Berdella bludgeoned Pearson with a tree limb until he was unconscious, then suffocated him with a plastic bag. Pearson's dismembered body was disposed of as Berdella had done with previous victims, but he kept Pearson's head in his freezer for some time before burying it in the backyard.
Yeah, that's the one that was buried in the backyard.
Yeah.
And then I can't remember what he told the hospital when he went to get his penis taken care of. I can't remember what the excuse was he said.
Christopher Bryson's captivity and eventual escape not only ended Berdella's reign of terror, but also exposed the full extent of his crimes. Bryson, a 22-year-old male prostitute, was lured to the Berdella's home under the pressure of exchanging sex for money. Once inside, Berdella incapacitated him with a blow to the head and restrained him, which is very different methodology. Typically, what he would do is he would invite them in, give them a drink, and drug them. This is the first victim that he actually hit over the head to incapacitate him.
I wonder what made him change up his...
Nobody knows. He never said. This one was weird, and this was the last one. Bryson was subjected to the same methods Berdella had refined over the years, including, and by the way, this is 1988 at this point.
So we've gone on for like a few years at this point.
Yeah. Bryson was subjected to the same methods, chemical burns to his eyes using ammonia. And I would just say that is temporary blindness. He was able to see after. Repeated sexual assaults and psychological torment, verbal threats including claims that Berdella had killed others and would do the same to Bryson. Bryson's ingenuity and courage ultimately led to his escape and Berdella's capture. Using matches left within reach, Bryson burned through his restraints and leapt from a second-story window despite severe injuries. Bryson's detailed account of his ordeal combined with the overwhelming evidence found in Berdella's home brought an end to the House of Horrors. So, in this, Robert Berdella was a smoker, so he had matches on the end table, on the bedside table. So he was able to wiggle his hands enough to grab the matches, and he was able to light the match and burn the restraints. And then he opened the second floor window, jumped out, and broke his leg.
We'll go more into the next part of. More into the escape.
Yeah, he jumps out, breaks his leg, and is butt-ass naked. Mm-hmm. During this period, Berdella transitioned from being a sadistic killer to a predator operating with a belief in his invulnerability. His ability to compartmentalize his public life and his crimes allowed him to carry out acts of unparalleled cruelty, making his eventual downfall a testament to the resilience of those who survived his horrors. The final chapter of Robert Berdella's monstrous crimes unfolded in March 1988, when his last known victim, just as we talked about, Christopher Bryson, made a daring escape. This period marked the culmination of Berdella's sadistic practices, but it also exposed the cracks in his carefully constructed facade. The series of events that led to Bryson's liberation highlighted not only the depth of Burdella's depravity, but also his growing carelessness, which ultimately brought his reign of terror to an end. Christopher Bryson, a 22-year-old male prostitute in Kansas City, became Burdella's final known victim. Like many of Burdella's prey, Bryson lived in the margins of society, struggling with instability and a lack of support. His vulnerability made him an ideal target for Burdella's manipulative attacks. On March 28, 1988, Burdella encountered Bryson while scouting for potential victims. Offering payment in exchange for sexual services, Burdella lured Bryson to his home at 4315 Charlotte Street. Once inside, Burdella incapacitated Bryson with a blow to the head using an iron bar, rendering him unconscious. When Bryson regained consciousness, he found himself stripped of clothing, gagged, and bound to a bed with his hands tied above his head. The scene mirrored Burdella's treatment of previous victims, foreshadowing the horrors to come. For 4 days, Bryson endured a relentless cycle of physical, psychological, and sexual abuse. Burdella employed his well-honed methods, ensuring that Bryson was both physically restrained and emotionally broken. Burdella repeatedly swabbed ammonia into Bryson's eyes, causing intense pain and temporary blindness. This act served to further incapacitate Bryson and heighten a sense of vulnerability. Burdella subjected Bryson to repeated rapes and other sexual violations. He documented these assaults in Polaroid photographs, as he had done with his previous victims. Burdella used fear as a tool of control, warning Bryson that resistance or escape attempts would result in greater suffering or death. He showed Bryson Polaroid photographs of previous victims, some of whom appeared to be dead. This chilling display was intended to instill terror and convince Bryson of his inevitable fate. Burdella continued to experiment with his victim, inflicting pain through beatings, gagging, and partial suffocation. Each act of cruelty was designed to strip Bryson of any remaining hope of survival. Despite his meticulous approach to previous crimes, Burdella's behavior during Bryson's captivity revealed a growing sense of overconfidence. By this time, he had refined his methods to the point where he believed himself untouchable, but his arrogance led to critical lapses in judgment. After 3 days of captivity, Burdella tied Bryson's hands in front of him rather than above his head, claiming it was to relieve circulation issues. The seemingly small act of leniency gave Bryson a crucial advantage.
Burdella started trusting Bryson within 3 days. Bryson asked, "Hey, can you move my hands in front of me? Can you do this for me? Can you do that?" And Burdella did it.
I'm shocked.
Burdella left a book of matches in the room where Bryson was restrained. While in oversight, it proved instrumental in Bryson's eventual escape. Burdella assumed that Bryson, like his previous victims, was too physically weakened and psychologically broken to resist. His miscalculation would prove fatal to his operation.
Yeah, like he would leave the remote for Bryson to watch TV when he left, and stuff like that, so.
Bryson's escape on March 29th, 1988, was a testament to his resilience and resourcefulness, even in the face of extreme adversity. The series of events leading to his liberation unfolded with a mix of desperation and determination. Using the matches left by Burdella, Bryson carefully burned through the ropes binding his wrists. This process required patience and precision to avoid detection, as any noise or disturbance could have alerted Burdella. He did burn himself while doing this.
I'm sure.
Once free, Bryson explored the second floor room where he was held, searching for an escape route. Despite his injuries and temporary blindness from the ammonia burns, he managed to locate a window. Bryson climbed through the second story window and leapt to the ground below. Fall resulted in a broken bone in his foot, but his determination to survive outweighed the pain. Wearing nothing but a dog collar, Bryson limped toward the street where he encountered a meter reader. Frantic and bloodied, he begged for help, explaining that he had been held captive and tortured. The meter reader quickly led him to a nearby home where the occupants called the police. The last time we did this, you were still meter reading.
Yeah.
And we talked about what you would have done.
Oh, God, the things you see doing that. I've never seen that, but honestly, that's about all you can do, because what a lot of meter readers will do is, at least what I did, was I would park my car at the end of one street and then just do like
walk up and then walk back and then go.
Pretty much. Sometimes depending on the size of the street or anything, I walk whole blocks, round whole blocks and everything. So I'm surprised anybody let him in.
Yeah. I mean, he was butt ass naked. And they didn't want to at first. They saw him and they were like, yeah, no. And when they asked the meter reader, he said, oh, I saw him come from here. And that's how they found the house. So the arrival of law enforcement marked the beginning of the end for Berdella's reign of terror. I love this too, because at this point he knew he was done and he just let them come in. They raided the house, but he didn't try and resist.
First of all, what's he going to do?
Yeah.
And
he was just, it was done.
It's really hard to explain a naked guy with a dog collar jumping out of your window. Because at the very least, in best case scenario, it's some kind of depraved sex act. And you're ruined one way or the other,
yeah.
Especially back then in the late 80s. Yeah, homosexuality was becoming more accepted, but nobody, even the people of the LGBTQ community, are going to have a hard time looking at this and thinking it's okay. Or again, as I said, I can't really explain that. So
yeah, Bryson recounted the events of his captivity with remarkable clarity, describing the methods of torture, the layout of Berdella's home, and the tools used to restrain him. He informed officers of the Polaroid photographs Berdella had shown him, suggesting the existence of other victims. Keep in mind, nobody knew anything. They had no idea that this dude was a fucking serial killer. Bryson's injuries, including chemical burns, bruises, and a broken foot, corroborated the story. The dog collar around his neck further emphasized the brutality of his captivity. Based on Bryson's account, police obtained a search warrant for Berdella's property. The warrant application cited Bryson's detailed testimony, the visible signs of torture, high likelihood of uncovering further evidence at the scene. And I will say, because don't really talk about it, they ended up calling EMS out. EMS was able to cover him, get him decent. He went to the hospital, got treated for his wounds. He was able to see later on. The ammonia only did temporary damage. They flushed his eyes, gave him a bunch of meds. I think he was in the hospital for a week or two just to get
normal
again.
And then between when he got out of the hospital and now, he vanished.
Yep.
He changed his name, recluded.
I would have.
Relocated to Southern Missouri and started a new life.
I would have.
Hopefully.
So the search for Berdella's home revealed the true extent of his crimes, exposing a house of horrors that shocked the Kansas City community and the nation. Police found burnt ropes still attached to the bedpost, the very ones Bryson had used matches to escape. A tray of syringes, chemicals, and torture implements, including the 7,700-volt transformer, was discovered near the bed. Yeah, he had it like a surgical room. He had the tray with the cart and everything. Hundreds of images depicted other victims in various stages of torture and death. These photographs provided damning evidence of Berdella's long history of abuse. Investigators uncovered skulls, bones, and other remains linking Berdella to multiple murders. Each discovery painted a clear picture of the scale of his atrocities. Christopher Bryson's escape not only saved his own life, but also brought justice to Berdella's other victims. His courage to recount his ordeal and the decisive action of law enforcement ensured that Berdella would face the full weight of the law. Bryson's survival and testimony provided the breakthrough investigators needed to end Berdella's killing spree and uncover his crimes. Again, the search of Berdella's home revealed a meticulous and calculated predator, whose ability to operate undetected for years highlighted the vulnerabilities in law enforcement's handling of marginalized communities. Christopher Bryson's escape was not just a moment of personal triumph. It was the final act in exposing one of Kansas City's most horrific serial killers. His resilience and bravery ensured that Berdella's crimes would no longer remain hidden. The investigation into Robert Berdella reaches climax when law enforcement executed a search warrant at 4315 Charlotte Street on March 29th, 1988, hours after Christopher Bryson's dramatic escape. That's how quickly they got the search warrant. It took them 2 hours. That was it. They called into the judge. The judge said, yep, boom, signed. Yeah. Actually, at this time, they would have gone to the judge's house.
But that's a quick fucking search warrant.
It's very quick, especially for that time. What awaited investigators inside the modest-looking Kansas City home would shock even seasoned officers and make national headlines. It's one of the most horrifying cases of serial murder ever uncovered. The evidence revealed not just the scale of Berdella's crimes, but also the meticulous and sadistic planning that had characterized his reign of terror. Here's the thing. So, we look at Ted Bundy. Okay. Yeah. Obviously one of the most prolific serial killers of all time. Trying to remember when his first murder was.
It was the late 70s, early 80s?
Yeah. 1971.
Oh, early 70s.
1971 in Seattle was his first one. But he wasn't sentenced until 1979. He was sentenced two in 1979, one in 1980. Then he escaped. Or he had his escape in 77. So Ted Bundy was at this point the most prolific serial killer. But his victims were known to be missing because he took people that would be missed.
Oh yeah.
Where this, nobody knew. Like, Ted Bundy was known to be out there. They knew there was a serial killer. They knew what he was driving. They did all of that. By the way, if you've never seen the movie with Zac Efron as Ted Bundy, watch it. It is amazing. He plays a great Ted Bundy.
Which is scary to think about.
I forget what it's called.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen it, but...
We'll have to watch it. Extremely wicked, shockingly violent, evil and vile. Great fucking movie. A lot of big names in it. Jim Parsons is in it. Sheldon. John Malkovich is in it. Haley Joel Osment's in it. Lily Collins is in it.
Oh, shit.
So, and Zac Efron played a great Ted Bundy. One of my favorites. So watch that great Ted Bundy, and we'll talk about that more when we do Ted Bundy.
If he didn't get comfortable with what he was doing,
actually,
two little mistakes.
Actually, realistically, with Ted Bundy, what got him killed was the point he just lost. He actually lost control.
Oh, I wasn't talking about that. Oh, I was talking about Robert Bardella.
We'll talk about Ted Bundy when.
No, Robert Bardella. Yeah, no, he got. He just got too complacent. Yeah. He just is like, no one cares about these people. And unfortunately, he was kind of right. I mean, nobody knew this was happening until literally one of his victims jumps out the window.
Well, that's what we're saying. It's like nobody would if he kept to what he was doing prior.
If he didn't become soft, I guess it's kind of hard to be hard when you get shit bitten off. But
I did get bitten off. It still functioned.
It still got bit. Ted Bundy's mistake was stealing the same fucking car that he drove when he was in Florida.
Yeah.
I don't get that. You are known to have a yellow fucking bug, and that's what they're looking for, and you go to Florida to escape, kill other girls driving a yellow bug. So Ted Bundy was a moron. Actually, he wasn't. He was very smart.
He was smart, but what made sure that he didn't get caught was, I mean, realistically, he didn't look like... Everybody always has this weird... He was a handsome man. He was charismatic. He was kind. He was... A lot of women desired him because he's like, oh, he's a good-looking man. He was able to get women off guard.
So, the police raid began with a sense of urgency. Bryson's harrowing testimony, his visible injuries gave investigators probable cause to believe that the home contained evidence of torture, murder, and potential other victims. So, I will say with that, technically, they did not need a search warrant. They did have probable cause to go inside. They could have gone inside. Now, they could not have searched anything.
Outside of his his immediate area.
No, they could have looked through the house because of probable cause. They just couldn't physically search. It's anything within eyesight.
Yeah.
So they could walk through, and if they see something, they can take it, but they can't go through and search drawers and stuff.
And yeah. I think at this point, because they realized how bad this was, they wanted to dot their I's, cross their T's.
Well, they didn't know how bad it was until they got in. They just...
Somebody made sure they were doing the right thing, because I think, if I remember correctly, about 10 years before, there was a Supreme Court case where it was just like that. They had probable cause to go in, but instead of just doing an immediate search of where he was that was invisible, they actually started searching, and then...
And everything gets thrown out.
Exactly.
The house was filled with random objects, junk, and artifacts from Berdella's flea market business. Bob's Bazaar Bazaar. I'm going to put Bob's Bazaar Bazaar in the campaign.
No.
Yes. No. But I'm going to put it the right way.
No.
Bob's Bazaar Bazaar. Investigators had to navigate through the cluttered space to locate evidence. Despite the disorder, there was a methodical organization in specific areas, suggesting that Berdella carefully curated spaces where he carried out his crimes. On entering the second floor bedroom, police immediately identified the scene where Bryson had been held captive. Burnt ropes were still attached to the bedpost, corroborating Bryson's accounts of his escape. Nearby, a tray containing syringes, prescription drugs, and household chemicals, ammonia among them, offered chilling confirmations of Bryson's testimony. The bed was equipped with leather straps and ropes designed to restrain victims securely. Tools such as alligator clips and electrical transformer later identified as capable of delivering 7,700 volts were discovered near the bed. These items were clearly used for inflicting pain and asserting dominance over Berdella's captives. The walls of the rooms displayed tribal art and macabre decorations, adding an eerie backdrop to the scene of unimaginable cruelty.
You know, I'm just thinking. So, you said from the time that he got his last victim where he was able to escape and the cops showed up, it was about 2 hours, right? This is just my opinion, I'm probably wrong, or at least one way he could have maybe, and I say maybe got away with it, takes all the photos, anything that doesn't look like a sex thing, he just burns it.
He wasn't there.
Oh, he wasn't.
He wasn't home.
Oh,
he was at work.
Oh shit,
yeah, he left.
He went to work went shopping or something. I forget what it was.
Okay, I thought he
was gone. He pulls up as the cops are searching his house.
Oh, yeah.
And he's just like, well, shit.
Here I'm thinking he's just in the house. Well,
Bryson literally asked. So after like 2 days, Berdella started trusting Chris. Then Chris is like, oh, can you leave the remote where I can reach it? Can you put my arms in front of me? Because he was completely compliant with Berdella. He lured Berdella into a false sense of ease. So him being able to have his arms in front of him, being able to watch TV, not doing anything, allowed Berdella, okay, well, he's not going to try to escape or do anything, so I can leave home. For an extended amount of time.
Well, I will say, he did leave home with all the other victims. He just had them tied up so they couldn't leave.
Yeah. Okay, I'm thinking he's went to the backyard or something.
He left. I think he went to work or something. He left for an extended period of time because he still had the bazaar at this point.
Yeah.
So he's still running that. So he would leave even with the other victims. They were just fully tied up. But he left and Bryson...
Escaped.
Used the TV, turned up the volume on the TV in case he came back so he couldn't hear him escape.
Okay.
And then he leapt out the window.
Because I'm thinking like he's in the, like he went in the backyard, Bryson was able to get out.
Nope, he's gone. So they're searching and his car just pulls up and he gets out and goes,
yep, shit.
Well, shit.
Because I'm thinking to myself, it's like, all he really has to do is get rid of all the photos of the previous victims and the... put the transformer and anything else like in the basement, like in a box. And all he can say is like, I'm gay. We got into some real kinky shit. He flipped out and he jumped out the window. I don't know what to say, officers.
Yep.
But if he's literally just pulls up and they're fine that, I'm like, well, no.
As the search expanded, law enforcement unearthed a trove of evidence that transformed the investigation from a case of assault and captivity to a horrifying revelation of serial murder. Investigators discovered hundreds of Polaroid photographs depicting men in various stages of captivity, torture, and death. Photographs revealed victims tied to beds, gagged, or subjected to physical abuse. Some images showed the victims post-mortem, with Berdella documenting their deaths as part of his gruesome experiments. The photos showed victims being subjected to electrical shocks, chemical burns, and sexual torture. Berdella had carefully cataloged these images, treating them as trophies to relive his sadistic fantasies. Next to the photographs, police found stenographer's pads filled with detailed shorthand entries, meticulously documenting Berdella's actions. Each entry recorded the methods of torture used, the victims' responses, and the progression of their physical and psychological deterioration. Specific phrases such as EKG for administering electric shocks and DC for injecting drain cleaner were repeatedly noted. Berdella's logs read like a scientist's observation of experiments, devoid of any empathy or recognition of his victims as human beings. Police found a range of tools that Berdella used to inflict pain and manipulate his victims. Hypodermic needles used to inject tranquilizer and caustic chemicals, ropes, belts, and chains for binding, household items like drain cleaner and caulking material used for chemical torture. The discovery of these items corroborated the grotesque methods described in Bryson's testimony and noted in Berdella's logs. And here is why he couldn't just put the stuff in the basement.
So with the log, the handwritten torture logs, I can't remember which victim it was, but he wrote 86.
Yeah.
Which is shorthand in a restaurant. We don't have it anymore. Right?
Yes. Yes. It means it's no longer on the menu. Ugh.
Yeah. He kept way too many notes.
Yeah, that's probably what he really just thought he wasn't going to get caught.
He didn't, because think about it. It started back in when he was in college. He had the two drug charges.
Mm-hmm.
What should have sent him, the second one, which should have sent him to jail.
Didn't,
because cops fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
So he just really thought, like, with this victim, that, oh, nothing's going to happen.
Yeah, he just keeps pushing a little bit. Nothing keeps happening until, yeah. Oh, oof, yeah.
I'm trying to find. I know I had what was exactly written in his logs. That's something I'm gonna have to find, and I'll actually post it. But I had a whole thing. It took me forever to find it, but I found somebody had recorded everything that was in his logs, which we don't typically have because it's
something like, something like that. They wouldn't post it.
Yeah. But I had found it. I had dug deep to find it. If I do find it, we'll post it on the website under the Scarlet Tavern part. The search of the basement revealed the gruesome aftermath of Berdella's murders. It was here that Berdella dismembered his victims after disposing of their remains. Using luminol, for those that don't know, luminol is the magical spray that makes blood stains or any stains come to light under blacklight. Forensic investigators detected extensive blood stains on the basement floor and trash barrels, evidence of where Berdella drained and butchered his victims. Investigators discovered a chainsaw and hacksaw both stained with blood and tissue, boning knives and other kitchen implements that Berdella used to methodically dismember his victims, and plastic sheets and tarps which were likely used to contain blood during the process. Human vertebrae scarred with tool marks consistent with a chainsaw were found in the basement. The teeth were stored in envelopes treated as macabre keepsakes by Berdella. That's why he couldn't just put stuff in the basement.
Yeah.
As investigators searched the outside the house, they uncovered further evidence of Berdella's crimes. A partially decomposed human head was found buried in a shallow grave in the backyard. It was later identified as belonging to Larry Wayne Pearson, Berdella's fifth victim. Additional fragments of bone were discovered, further confirming that Berdella used his property to dispose of parts of his victims. Who was... There was a serial killer who buried a victim in his backyard and made it look inside the window.
Yeah, there was a couple. I know there was one. It was actually, I believe it was in Indiana. He buried the victims in the backyard. And I think at one point his wife or somebody had found it. And he like explained that like, oh, this since it was like a family home, he's like, oh, my dad was he's a doctor, you know. He used to, when he was in medical school, he would steal dead bodies and experiment on them to get, like, extra practice. And then he didn't know what else to do, so I guess he just buried him in the backyard.
What the fuck?
You know, I don't know what was more incredible, that he was able to literally pull that story. He literally his wife is out gardening. She finds, like, a femur. Or some kind of like something that this is very identifiable as from a human. And he just comes up with this on the spot. That's incredible. What I think was even more incredible is that she actually believed him.
That's what it is. Herbert Mullen. So Herbert Mullen was a serial killer in California in the early 70s. He killed 13 people. We'll do an episode on him at some point. But he positioned the body so that it was facing the window of his home. So when he looked out the window, he could see it every time.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, that's what it reminded me of. He was fucking psycho. So we'll do an episode on him. That was a good one. He believed his murders were necessary to stop the California earthquakes in the 70s. That's why he killed people.
Jesus
Christ. Yeah. He was delusional.
Yeah, you think?
The living room showcased the disturbing duality of Berdella's life. The room was filled with tribal art and exotic curiosities, reflecting the eccentric persona Berdella cultivated at the flea market. Mixed among these items were personal effects belonging to his victims, including Jerry Howell's driver's license and James Ferris's wallet. These trophies served as chilling reminders of his crimes. Items related to Berdella's involvement in the local neighborhood watch programs were found, underscoring the stark contrast between his public image and private depravity. The evidence collected during the search painted a picture of a methodical, calculated killer who had spent years perfecting his sadistic practices. Investigators were able to reconstruct Berdella's timeline of crimes based on the logs, photographs, and victim testimonies. Each victim was held for days or weeks, subjected to escalating levels of torture before succumbing to their injuries. Evidence linked Berdella to at least six known victims: Jerry Howell, Robert Sheldon, Mark Wallace, James Ferris, Todd Stoops, and Larry Wayne Pearson. Photographs suggested the possibility of additional unidentified victims, raising questions about the full extent of Berdella's killing spree.
I mean, if you looking at this, just a cursory glance of the times it's supposed to be there, there are these interesting gaps that are in between there. And as I was actually thinking, it's like, well, what the hell is he doing in the meantime? Because there doesn't seem to be...
They count way more than six.
Oh, I'm sure. I
think he started to do the torture and they died too quickly. So he didn't make any notes. He just took pictures of them. And the way he would take pictures, he would blur their faces. He would cover a lot of their faces. So, and back then, there was no way to identify people like that.
No, not
they,
without.
They didn't have facial recognition.
No.
You had to have photo to photo.
And I don't know. So you don't think you've seen... Some of my mom's old photos, the Polaroid ones, they're all distorted.
Oh yeah.
I think we end up.
No, I don't know what Polaroid photos are at all.
I said my mom's Polaroids.
I've seen Polaroids.
I mean, we weren't alive when you were, but Ben's baby pictures were on Polaroids. Actually, his baby pictures were chiseled into stone.
Yeah.
But,
I'm surprised the stone didn't break.
Yeah. Mm. As news of the discovery spread, the Kansas City community was engulfed in a mixture of shock, outrage, and disbelief. Berdella, who had been seen as an eccentric but harmless figure, was unmasked as one of the most sadistic killers in the city's history, in the world's history. The term House of Horrors became synonymous with Berdella's home, and the grotesque details of the case dominated headlines nationwide. Community members expressed frustration that such atrocities could occur in their midst for years without detection. The victims' families, while grateful for the closure, struggled to cope with the horrifying details of their loved ones' final moments. The raid on 4315 Charlotte Street not only ended Burdella's crimes, but also exposed systemic issues and how society and law enforcement overlooked vulnerable populations. The evidence collected during the search became the foundation for a case that would secure justice for Burdella's victims and ensure his place in the annals of criminal infamy. The legal proceedings against Robert Burdella were among the most disturbing, meticulously documented criminal cases in Kansas City's history. The court case and subsequent plea deals revealed the full extent of Burdella's crimes while igniting a public and legal reckoning. This phase of the story highlights how the justice system navigated the complexities of prosecuting one of the most sadistic serial killers ever exposed. Robert Burdella was arrested on March 29, 1988, hours after Christopher Bryson's daring escape. The evidence gathered during the search of Burdella's home provided a basis for the following initial charges: felonious restraint, for unlawfully holding Christopher Bryson captive; first-degree assault, for the physical and psychological torture inflicted on Bryson; sodomy charges, 7 counts of forcible sodomy based on Bryson's detailed testimony. So he raped him 7 times in 3 days. These initial charges allowed law enforcement to keep Burdella in custody while they continued their investigation into the suspected murders. So they... because you have 48 hours to hold. Mm-hmm. So by presenting these charges, they now have 48 hours to get evidence of the rest of the crimes.
Yep. Well, 48 hours they can arrest him without charging him. No, it's 24 hours to charging him. But once, I mean, they already charged him.
These are initial charges, which means he did not go to court yet. Okay. This is what they're holding him on. And with that, they can hold him for 48 hours till he has to go to court.
Yeah, and then he has to do.
Yes.
Okay, I thought you were saying like then they got to release him. I'm like, what? No, they wouldn't release him.
He has to go to court. But then, and you got to remember that it would then be 2 separate cases, and they can't do anything about this because then that's double jeopardy.
Yep.
These initial charges allowed law enforcement to keep Burdella in custody while they continued their investigation of the suspected murders. As investigators uncovered more evidence linking Burdella to additional victims, prosecutors convened a grand jury to examine whether sufficient grounds existed to charge him with murder. Over the course of several weeks, the grand jury heard testimony from law enforcement officers involved in the search and investigation, forensic experts who analyzed the photographs, torture logs, and physical evidence, and surviving victim Christopher Bryson, whose detailed testimony laid the foundation for the case. The grand jury ultimately returned indictments for first-degree murder in the cases of Larry Wayne Pearson and Robert Sheldon, as well as charges related to the other identified victims. Initially, Burdella invoked his right to remain silent, refusing to provide any information to investigators. He maintained a calm and detached demeanor even as the evidence against him mounted. Faced with overwhelming evidence, Burdella's defense team recognized the futility of contesting the charges in court. They negotiated plea deals to spare Burdella the death penalty in exchange for full confessions and cooperation. Prosecutors accepted the plea agreements to avoid the emotional toll of a protracted trial and to ensure that Burdella could not appeal a death sentence. On December 19th, 1988, Burdella entered guilty pleas for the following charges: first-degree murder, 1 count for the murder of Larry Wayne Pearson, and second-degree murder, 4 counts for the murders of Jerry Howell, Mark Wallace, James Ferris, and Todd Stoops. Why they charged it different.
Yes. Larry Wayne Pearson, it was because he was motivated because he had his penis bit.
No.
No?
That's not why. No.
I actually do not.
It was the decapitation. Larry Wayne Pearson's the one he decapitated and took the head off. It's so with the second degree murder, it's a lesser one because second degree murder is what you get with crimes of passion and things like that. You're cutting somebody's head off, that's no longer a crime of passion.
Yeah, that's deliberate.
That's deliberate. You are doing that. You're not going to sit there for an hour to cut somebody's head off and go, I don't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At a certain point, you got to be like, okay, whoa, wait a minute. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why got put up to first degree murder. He was sentenced to life in prison without parole for the first degree murder conviction and consecutive life sentences for the second degree murder convictions, ensuring that Berdella would never leave prison. And so I'll explain this to people that don't know. So he got life in prison without parole for Larry Wayne Pearson. He also got consecutive life sentences. So if he had just had consecutive life sentences, he is eligible for parole. Just because you have life sentences doesn't mean you're not eligible for parole. That life in prison without parole is the massive thing. Now, without parole does not mean that can't be overturned. That can be.
Oh, yeah.
You can file an appeal. You can do all of that. But with the consecutive life sentences on top of that, to run, and they would have run congruent. So they try and specify running congruent, which means that it's
all at the same time.
All four of these. Not at the same time, one after the other.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's consecutive. Yeah. That's why they do it. So if one is just
boom, boom, boom. So if he appeals one, the next one comes in.
Yeah. Yeah.
He appeals that one, the next one comes in. You're not appealing all four. You don't have the time. The appeal court takes forever.
If it had been concurrent, then they would have all just been lumped in this one. And if he appealed one, he's kind of appealed them all.
They're like, overturning those are almost impossible.
I mean, at that point, I mean, I don't think nobody ever really thought this guy was. I mean, the warrant's executed perfectly. There's probable cause. I mean,
yeah.
Naked dude with a dog collar jumps out of a window. I would say you have good cause to enter that home at that point.
Additional sentences for sodomy and felonious restraint in the Christopher Bryson case further solidified his life imprisonment, so he did get charged for the other ones as well. The plea deals provoked mixed reactions. Many victims' families expressed relief that Berdella's cooperation provided answers about their loved ones' fates. Others were angered that Berdella was spared the death penalty, feeling that his crimes warranted the ultimate punishment. Kansas City residents grappled with the horrifying reality that Berdella had lived among them, cultivating a facade of eccentricity and civic-mindedness while committing unspeakable acts. So here's the thing. I firmly believe in eye for an eye.
Oh, yeah.
I think whatever you do to your victim is what should be done to you.
Oh, yeah.
If you rape and torture your victim, you should be raped and tortured. If you kill your victim, you behead your victim, that should happen to you. That's just me. I also think we should bring back the firing squad and lynching. But I think we get people like this and we hang them outside City Hall, people stop doing shit.
I don't think with Robert Berdella, his depravity, I don't think there's any deterrent on earth that would have stopped someone like Robert Berdella, stop them from doing this. I think that they were just so, it's one thing to deter, like, if I rob a convenience store, that's how I make my living, and if one day I'm going outside City Hall and I see three guys I know who are also rob stores for a living, and they're just swinging from the thing, yeah. Yeah, maybe I'll rethink my life, go find a real job or something. But Robert Berdella's mind is broken. He's fucked in the head. Yes, his parents really set the stage for it to happen and everything. You could swing 100 Robert Berdellas from a tree. It's not going to stop the 101st.
I also don't believe in the death sentence in the traditional sense. I think the death sentence is an easy out. I think his victims were tortured and everything, and oh, now we're just going to inject him and let him go to sleep peacefully. I mean, the first few seconds is pain, but other than that, it's peaceful. He just gets to fall asleep.
And unfortunately,
I don't believe in the death sentence.
Unfortunately, no matter what, unless we do exactly what that is, and I'm sure we'd find somebody who would do something similar. Gladly do something similar to someone like Robert Berdella, but that's just how it is. Dead to me, dead is dead. He's dead. Okay, yeah, you're right. He didn't get to suffer like he made his poor victims did, but he's at the end of the day still dead, and we never have to worry about him ever again. We don't have to think about him ever again. So
until people do podcast episodes on him,
yes, that's about it. Outside of an academic setting. dead is dead. He's dead. He's gone. He'll never do this again. They were never. He was never going to get parole or whatever. Yeah. So yeah, I guess it's not as 100% satisfying of inflicting the same pain on him that he so richly deserves. But you know,
as part of the plea agreements, Berdella provided chillingly detailed confessions about his crimes. These confessions painted a horrifying picture of a methodical, sadistic killer who viewed his victims as objects for experimentation. Berdella describes his use of electrical shocks to inflict pain and submission, chemical injections including drain cleaner to silence or incapacitate victims, sexual violence and psychological manipulation to break his victim's will. He admitted to holding each victim captive for days or weeks before killing them, using chainsaws, boning knives, and other tools to dismember the bodies, and disposing of remains in garbage bags for curbside trash collection. Just imagine, this comes out, that Robert Berdella is disposing of a victim in trash bags, and you're the trash man watching this on the news, and you go, God, those bags felt heavy.
It's like, holy fuck! That's why!
That's why! Like, I just threw this fucking body in the fucking garbage with Miss Smith's meatloaf.
Jesus.
Berdella confessed that he deliberately targeted vulnerable individuals, young men struggling with addiction, homelessness, or prostitution, because he believed they would not be missed. Throughout his confessions, Berdella showed little remorse. He described his actions with clinical detachment, referring to his victims as play toys, and justifying his crimes as experiments to satisfy his sadistic urges. Following his sentencing, Berdella was incarcerated at the Missouri State Penitentiary. Been there. His time behind bars was marked by complaints, attempts to control his public image, and his eventual health decline. Berdella frequently filed grievances about prison conditions, claiming inadequate medical care or poor food quality.
Oh, poor baby.
Fucking yeah, suck a nut.
Yeah, seriously.
Well, maybe not.
He specifically cited issues related to his high blood pressure, which he argued was not being properly managed. Go fuck yourself.
Hey, maybe not be a sadistic fucking asshole and killer, and maybe you...
Oh, I guarantee you, and I'll say this right now, I guarantee you they were mistreating him.
Oh, probably.
On purpose.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious what his fellow prisoners probably thought of him.
I'll just wait.
You'll see. Berdella granted occasional interviews attempting to portray himself as misunderstood. He claimed that media coverage had exaggerated his crimes, further enraging victims' families and the public. Due to the notoriety of his crimes, Berdella was placed in protective custody to prevent attacks by other inmates. His isolation only deepened his detachment and narcissistic tendencies. They wanted to kill him. They were running through here saying, we want to kill him. And eventually the warden was like, yeah, I don't want that on my record. Let's go put him in solitary and let him die of his own whatever. On October 8th, 1992, I was a few months old, Berdella died of a heart attack at the age of 43. His death was attributed to complications from long-standing high blood pressure.
I can imagine just a guard probably opened up the slot to look inside the cell and saw him dead. And he's like, oh, that's what he meant by this needing his med. Oh, man, my face is red.
Oh, well.
Yeah, he's like, oh, should I report this? That's lunchtime.
I'll take a break. I'm going home.
I would have been like, yeah, he'll keep till the morning.
Many in the Kansas City community expressed relief that Berdella would no longer be a burden on the prison system or a source of ongoing attention. Some question whether Berdella's death was truly natural, but no evidence of foul play was found, which it wouldn't be because they would hide it.
Also, I mean, realistically, if they're going to go through all the... If they really just wanted him dead, like in terms of like foul play, take him out of solitary, throw him into the general population, and let nature take its course. It's a lot easier, and it's also kind of takes your hands off of it as opposed to finding some drug to inject him with or put in his food and just to kill him.
But who's saying that a prisoner didn't do that?
In isolation, if he's in solitary confinement,
his food is prepared separately.
Yeah, he has no inmates
don't prepare the food. It's prepared separately and all of that. So the case against Robert Berdella left a lasting impact on the Kansas City community and beyond. The investigation highlighted the importance of thoroughly pursuing missing persons cases, especially those involving marginalized individuals. The role of survivor testimony, as exemplified by Christopher Bryson, became a critical element in bringing serial killers to justice. While Berdella's confessions provided answers, the graphic details of his crimes reopened wounds for many families. The destruction of Berdella's home in 1989 symbolized an effort to erase the physical reminders of his atrocities. So what we saw was a rebuild.
Okay.
Yeah, so a person bought Berdella's house, demolished it. He's like, I don't want that as a house of horror museum and shit.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Kind of like with the person who now owns the Amityville Horror House. They completely redid the front of it so everyone would stop bothering his house.
Berdella's crime sparked discussions about the dangers faced by vulnerable populations and the necessity of community vigilance. The House of Horrors case became a focal point for true crime media, with books, documentaries, and podcasts exploring the depths of Berdella's depravity. Court case and its aftermath brought justice for Berdella's victims and exposed the systemic failures that allowed his crimes to go unnoticed for so long. While his life ended in obscurity, the impact of his actions serves as a grim reminder of the importance of vigilance, compassion, and the pursuit of justice for the most vulnerable members of society. In episode 2, we've delved into the heart of Robert Berdella's crimes, exploring the chilling realities behind his unassuming exterior and the devastating impacts of his actions. This house of horrors serves as a grim reminder of the depths of human depravity and the vulnerabilities of marginalized individuals. Just questions to reflect on as we leave. How can communities better protect vulnerable populations from predators like Berdella? What lessons can be learned from the systemic gaps that allowed his crimes to persist for so long? And with that, we want to thank you for visiting the Scarlet Tavern. Please remember to turn in your glasses, push in your seat, and as always, tip the bard. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.